So welcome, everyone. My name is Colleen Russell. I am a transformational creativity coach and your host on this call. This afternoon, I'll be in conversation with Dr. Tina Stromstead, who is joining us today from San Francisco to talk about re-inhabiting the body, authentic movement as a pathway to transformation. We will explore what it means to live a vital, embodied life in our modern world. Dr. Tina Stromstead is a Jungian analyst, somatic psychotherapist, and board-certified dance movement therapist with a private practice in San Francisco. Past co-founder and faculty of the Authentic Movement Institute in Berkeley, and a founding faculty of the Women's Spirituality Program at CIIS. She teaches at the C.G. Jung Institute of San Francisco and in the Depth Psychology Somatics Doctoral Program at Pacifica Graduate Institute. Her international teaching includes work in Canada, Europe, Asia, and South Africa, with roots in theater and dance, and nearly 40 years of clinical experience. Her numerous publications explore the integration of body, mind, psyche, and soul in healing and transformation. She has studied with pioneering Jungian analyst Marion Woodman since the 1980s, co-facilitated Body Soul Rhythms Leadership Training Intensives, and teaches regularly for the Marion Woodman Foundation. Dr. Stromstead's work includes dream dancing, an approach she developed that engages the healing power of dreams in the body and soul's body and integration of somatics and Jungian depth work. If you would like to find out more about Tina and her work, you can go to www.authenticmovement-bodysoul.com. So I'll say that again. It's www.authenticmovement-bodysoul.com. I will be recording this call, so if for some reason you're unable to stay with us for the entire call, know that I will be sending out a link to my email list in just a couple of days. If you're not currently on my email list and would like to be informed of these free monthly teleseminars exploring the wisdom of the body soul, please go to www.quest4wholeness.com. That's www.quest4wholeness, WHOLENESS.com, and sign up for my free bi-monthly newsletter. You will then receive articles on spirituality, creativity, and the search for wholeness, and information on future teleseminars and workshops. Also, if you know of others that would benefit or enjoy these types of conversations, please feel free to pass this information and recording along. It will also be posted on Tina's website later on in the week. I have muted the call to keep out as much background noise as I can. However, we will be opening up the call at the end of the hour so that you may ask Tina or I any questions you may have. Our call today will last from an hour and 15 minutes to an hour and a half. I hope you will join me again just next week on May 6th, 2 o'clock Pacific time, as I interview Canadian author Dr. Marlene Schwebe on her book Simple Days, exploring the topic of how we create simple, balanced, meaningful, and perhaps more soulful lives for ourselves in a world that is filled with so many distractions. I am excited about the call today because authentic movement is an integral part of the Body Soul Rhythms Leadership Program that was developed by Jungian analyst Marion Woodman Mary Hamilton, and Ann Skinner. To find out more information about Body Soul Rhythm trainings and the offerings available, please visit www.marianwoodmanfoundation.org. That's www.marianwoodmanfoundation.org. Just last week, as I was preparing for this teleconference, I was listening to a CD by Marian Woodman on addiction. And one of the things that she said is that what happens to the psyche happens to the body. And that what happens to the body happens to the psyche. The body and the psyche are intertwined. Yet for years, we have ignored the wisdom of the body. I know personally, too, before joining the Body Soul Leadership Training, that I was really disconnected from my body. I don't even think I lived in my body. Working for a corporation in my early 30s, I learned to override the symptoms and the voice of my body by using caffeine, sugar, and alcohol to get it to respond how I needed so that I could keep going day after day. When I was 35, my husband died suddenly of a heart attack, and after that I got really sick and developed an autoimmune disease.
Oh, yeah.
My poor body could no longer carry the burden of being ignored. Didn't matter if it was night or day, my body ached, and I spent thousands of dollars on chiropractors, massage therapists, and other body workers trying to alleviate the pain. And I'm sure that each one of those helped me to become more conscious, but I still hadn't developed a loving relationship with my body. I still saw the body as something that needed to be fixed. And during the Body Soul Leadership Training and the authentic movement that was facilitated by Tina, I grew to love and respect my body and no longer wanted to cause it harm. And in the work that I did in the leadership training and the authentic movement, I was able to release some of the stored trauma and to connect with the lost parts of myself. And through the active imagination work that is a part of the process, I began to connect to my creativity, which has fed my soul ever since. More importantly, through this work with Tina, I developed a strong sense of self so that caring for the body, my body, became important to me. And I'm happy to say that as I continue to do this work and continue to make the changes necessary to really care for my body, that my life is transformed. Authentic movement gave me the strength and courage to give up flour, sugar, alcohol, and caffeine, and to stop polluting my body. And I've learned to be present with my body and more conscious of the mind-body connection. I firmly believe, personally, that if we don't learn how to see and experience our bodies as sacred, that we will not learn how to value the earth as sacred either, that these two are also connected. During my time in the BSR work, I had the pleasure of working with Dr. Tina Stronstedt. And Tina is so loving and down to earth. I know you will enjoy her as we do our best to give language to something that is highly experiential today.
Mm-hmm.
Before I introduce you to Tina, I'd like to invite each of you on the call today to just take a minute and let us drop into our bodies, since for many of us it's the end of the day or it's the middle of the day. So what I'd like you to do is to begin by just connecting to the breath. Just let yourself breathe in and out. And notice your breath. Does it feel at ease? Or is it caught anywhere in your body? And if so, begin to breathe into that place where it feels caught. And as you breathe, allow your awareness to travel down into your feet. And maybe even wiggle your toes. And feel your feet connected to the ground beneath you. Now imagine that your feet are connected to Mother Earth, soul to soul, as I've heard Tina say before. And imagine, too, that you can send a cord of light down into the earth, down through the layers of soil, clay, rock, to the rivers, beneath the rivers, and begin to bring up the energies of the earth into your body, much like a taproot of a great tree might. And feel the energy as it comes up your ankles, moves up your calves, into your thighs, and into the pelvic area, beginning with the sitz bones on the bottom, which represents the first chakra, that place in us that gives our sense of belonging. And breathe out any tension you might find there. Next, bring the energy of the earth into your second chakra, often where our sexual organs reside, the center of creativity, the area where life renews itself, and release any tension there as you move it to the third chakra, that area above, just above your belly button, and right sort of in the middle of your ribs, below your heart, which is where you experience your center of power. And breathe relaxation into that part of your body. And then bring it all the way into your heart chakra. And as you do, allow it to spread across your shoulders, relaxing your body, and allowing any old energies that you might be carrying from the day to slide down your arms and back into the earth, allowing the mother to do what she does so well, which is to compost those energies. And as you stay connected to your breath and your feet, imagine that you can send a cord of light from the top of your head, from that soft spot that babies have, which is the seventh chakra, and that you can send a cord of light from you into the heavens, up where the sun, the moon, the stars and galaxies reside. And imagine that you can invite the energies from the heavens into your body. Experience it entering there in your seventh chakra, and then feeling it opening and then nourishing that spot known as the third eye in the middle of your forehead that awakens our intuition, and bringing a sense of ease into your face and into your jaws, those areas where we often hold so much of our tension. And then allow it, this energy from the heavens, to drop down into your throat chakra, that place where we speak and give words to our truth, allowing any tension there to release, And finally, bring this energy from the heavens into the heart chakra and allow it to dance and commingle with the energies of the earth, bringing the opposites together in the area of your heart, feeling yourself connected to the earth, nurtured from both the earth and the heavens. And as you do, connect with the flow of your breath again. And allow yourself to just take a moment to connect with the miracle of your body. As I drop in these words from our beloved Marion Woodman, this is your body, your greatest gift. Pregnant with wisdom you cannot hear, grief you thought you had forgotten, and joy you have not yet known. This is your body, your greatest gift. Pregnant with wisdom you cannot hear, grief you thought you had forgotten, and joy you have not yet known. And as you sit in that silence, feeling connected to your body, I'd like to welcome Tina. Are you still with us, Tina?
I sure am, and I'm much better for your meditation.
Me too.
That is the magic of it.
Yeah.
It works, and it's so important to take even just a few moments each day to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was feeling pretty tense in my own body there at the beginning of the call, and it relaxed me right down as well.
Mm-hmm. That's a well-kept secret that it's as great for the practitioner as it is for, you know, who they're offering it to.
That's great.
Yeah.
So it's so nice to have you on the call with us today. I know you're a busy woman, Tina, and I appreciate that you take time out to speak with us. And
oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to offer that we just jump right in so we can get as much information out of you while we've got you on the line.
Okay, I'll do my best. I don't quite know what's going to happen, but I think that's the way of the world, isn't it?
Yeah, we'll just open to the mystery here.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you can, if you would start out by just telling us a little bit about you and your story and how you became so involved with the work of the body as a vehicle for transformation.
Thank you. You know, it's interesting as an analyst, you know, when you're sitting and working with people, you don't often speak a lot about your own story. But I think it's important at different times to ground what we offer in the reality of our own lived experience. Mm-hmm. And you know, Marion's been an inspiration for me, Marion Woodman, in that her work too, as I think it does for all of us, came out of her life struggles and dilemmas and deep challenges. And I think, you know, it's through the wounding as well as the gifts that we get when we're growing up that our own work develops and evolves over time. It's as if it has to. You know, Jung calls that individuation, that process of becoming more whole, more fully who we are, with all of our various bits, known and unknown and undeveloped and beginning to develop, and sometimes maybe never developed in one lifetime. So having said that, just to say a little bit about myself, I think maybe like all of us, when I was a child, I loved to wiggle around and move, and I was very curious about the world and, you know, felt the reality of my life through my body before my body became more inhibited. And, you know, parents are often doing the best they can for better and for worse, and sometimes don't have the patience that we wish they did, but they're just doing what they can. And so my mother, who had an increasing number of children, used to say, don't fidget. Stop wiggling. So I started keeping my wiggling and my fidgeting, so to speak, more to myself. I thought of it more as dance, not really as fidgeting. But one really good thing she did was that she enrolled me in a ballet class. And I loved it. I loved being able to move freely and with others. I will say, though, that over time, for me, it began to feel like a lesson in perfectionism, because the goal was not so much to be in your body and be connected to the earth, as you so beautifully led us in, Colleen, with your meditation.
Thank you.
But to soar to the heavens, to the transcendent, to in some ways get out of your body. And, you know, I still find it a very beautiful art form, and I have a number of friends and colleagues who are ballet dancers, so there's nothing against it. It's just that for me it became a little bit like military training, you know,
mm-hmm.
where you have to hold your head just so and be up on toe and point shoes, which are really bad for your feet, and do things that your body really isn't made to do, you know, stretch your leg up so it meets your ear and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're a child, you can do a lot of that. You're made out of rubber bands. But later you pay for it a little. And for me, it did not allow me to express my feelings and my longing to connect with other people and with community. And so I gradually somehow got permission to migrate from ballet to modern jazz, blues dance, to African dance, which I still love. And I think there was something about that drum, you know, which the Africans call the mother's heartbeat, the heartbeat of Mother Earth, mm-hmm. literally, where you don't count it out. You connect with the heartbeat in yourself, and that helps mm-hmm. you connect with the heartbeat of the earth. And there are no mirrors in those dance studios. Instead, you're learning the dances of the seasons, the cycles of nature, like in the myths of Demeter and Persephone, all those great myths. And you're learning to connect with a circle of people and community. So instead of studying your image in the mirror, which women are raised to do since we've been little teeny girls, you look into the eyes of other people and you connect. And you connect with yourself emotionally, and you connect with the cycles of nature, and you connect with the earth. So that was very important for me. And I think I'll also say that just a little more specifically, I developed a bit of a split, which I think many of us do in this culture and other, you know, industrialized forward-moving cultures and probably others as well, where there was what was going on at the dinner table, above the dinner table with my very bright parents, very Ivy League and well-meaning and very interested in leftist politics and in education. This is my father and my stepmother. And I could participate in that, and I was trained to think like that, and it was interesting, but it felt soulless to me. And what I got much more interested in is what was going on under the dinner table, where all the knees were fidgeting and mm-hmm. people were doing things, really mm-hmm. interesting things with their feet and with their hands, wringing their hands or picking their nails or holding themselves mm. or sometimes moving in more lyrical ways if they were happier. And I think that emotional realm is kind of where my biological mother lived in a way. She left when I was about 7.5. So in some ways, I was navigating my two mothers as a feminine being, but also the reality of the split in our culture between the head and the body, between logos and eros, emotion. So I had to, you know, when I finished my chores, I had to get myself out as quickly as I could into the alfalfa fields across the street and dance and spin and turn long before I knew about Sufi turning, just as a little girl. And it was there that I experienced, what can I call it, the transcendent, I have to say, that sense of the shimmer in the body and that connection with the birch trees and the alfalfa and the sun and the clouds and the earth beneath my feet, this sense of incredible oneness. And I think it's that that I have been tending my whole life ever since then. It's that spark, that soul life, and how to recognize it in oneself and in another through witnessing, how to support it, how to help it grow, how to help others recognize the signs of it in themselves and what it's like to lose it, mm-hmm. and how to what that feels like and how to regain it. So maybe in summarizing, I'll say too that I would come back from the fields and go into the back room in the house and put on records. Remember records?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And dance with my little sisters. I think those were my first dance therapy groups. I would be back there by myself, and they would come up and put their noses on the glass of the door and sort of just try to see what was happening, and I would just say, come on in. And we'd dance together and had a wonderful time. So I think that was a very soul-saving, very healing kind of experience. And from there, I continued to take dance classes. I studied yoga and mime. I tried to find a way to connect my voice and my thoughts up with my nonverbal dancing body. And some of that came through theater, because the characters were free to really express a lot of different feelings and not just stuck in thought. And not only moving, but also speaking. So that also helped with the healing. And then later on, I started teaching dance classes. And this is in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I used to live. And people would come up and say, you know, what are we doing? What are we doing? I'd say, well, it's dance. And they'd say, well, it's more than dance. And they would want to start pouring out their life story. And I was so moved by what they had to say, what the movement was evoking, that I realized I needed to try to explore that more and to try to find a way to honor their stories and to hold their stories and to understand them better. But we only had, you know, 10 or 15 minutes to change back into our street clothes before the next dance class would come in. So I started doing volunteer work in a place called McLean's. It's a psychiatric hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
integrating dance and poetry and art and working in nature, and then realized I needed more psychological chops and went on to do my master's and my PhD in psychology, always keeping the embodied aspect there, because when you study psychology, you can get a little into your head.
You think.
The best of intentions, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and maybe I'll say one last thing, which is somehow I was always trying to keep a foot in each world, the world of the psyche, the verbal world. Later on, I learned to call that my Jungian practice, working with dreams, the imagination, and the deep world of the body, the felt sense, which Wilhelm Reich was exploring, you know, as a protege of Freud.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to call these two groups of people the tractors and the butterflies. The Reichians were the tractors. They dug deep into the earth of somatic experience. And the Reichians, for me, were the butterflies who looked at transformation through the imagination and sometimes could get a little in their heads. When I was with the Reichians, and I would say, my God, I had this very moving experience in the work last week, and it gave rise to this dream. Can I speak to that? And the person I was studying with said, you know, we don't do dreams here. I don't know about that. You know, he was honest enough to say that. And then when I was working with the Reikians and I said, I felt this dream come alive in my body and I began to move it to find out more. And the Jungians I knew early on in those days, you know, in the 70s and 80s, said, well, you know, we don't really work with the body. And so I think my work by necessity, which is true, I think, for most, if not all of us, was to build a kind of bridge or find an integration between the tractors and the butterflies, let's say, the deep diggers in the earth, and those who work so beautifully with the imaginal and the psyche in that way. Mm. So now we're talking about the embodied psyche, embodied, the development, gradual, painstaking development of embodied consciousness.
Yeah,
so that's kind of a long answer, but maybe it's woven some ideas in there too.
Yeah, it was beautifully said, Tina. I could feel my own body relax and smile as you're talking about dancing with the seasons of nature and looking into the eyes of people and dancing in the fields of alfalfa and the clouds. It's like we have forgotten that part of ourselves in childhood or something.
Mm-hmm.
I remember those days as well, and I'm so touched and so honored to be with you today with the integrity with which you bring to this work that you do and the longevity of it and the natural part of you that it is.
Thank you. Thank you. I still have lots to learn, and it's an exciting journey.
Yeah.
Not always easy, but deeply meaningful.
Never boring, I'm sure.
No.
Yeah. And I remember as I was reading your article preparing for the interview, Tina, that you talked about that the journey through life is not simply metaphorical or psychological or spiritual that you just kind of touched on right now, but also concretely experienced in the body, and that if we get in touch with the body, that the body can act as a compass to guide our life's course. I'm wondering if you can say more about what the body holds for us and what how the body serves us in a way.
I feel and sense and in my work with others see the body very much as a conduit for the wisdom of our inner life. Jung would call it the wisdom of the self. It's full of deep cellular intelligence, you know, that comes in the evolution of all life forms. I mean, if you think of it, if we had to figure out how to make a body, you know, we'd be very hard-pressed. There's such a genius to it. So I think this work is really about learning step by step to begin to listen again to the intelligence of the body, which is, you know, far greater than what our ego has, what we've been able to develop in a single lifetime. It goes back millennia, you know, to when we were tadpoles and all the way up through all of the various species to when we developed a mammalian brain and becoming the way we are. So my sense is when we get stuck or when we get blocked or shamed or any of these things that can feel so painful when we're expressing challenging feelings or even joy, maybe like the don't fidget. I didn't think I was fidgeting, as I said. You know, we push those things down. And so to be able to listen again, and breath is very important for this, to open to the breath and allow ourselves to be guided by what is present in this moment, what I'm sensing in my body, and how that becomes or can become a compass, a real guide for what is true north for any of us. You know, what is true for me in this moment? What am I aware of? What's guiding me? Instead of learning to function from the head, which is what this culture often teaches us to do, how to fix ourselves, what's the right thing to do? And we search for it in others and in books and you know, there's nothing the matter with that, but we then can get very far afield from what's right here at home in our own body.
Mm-hmm.
So here's actually something that my dear friend and colleague, Joan Chaudhuro, who's also a Jungian analyst and a dance therapist, one of the pioneering dance therapists, and I think the first Jungian analyst to be a dance therapist. She's also a dear friend of Marion's and was doing this work long, you know, from many, many years back. She says, in terms of the body being concrete and not only metaphor or spiritual, she says, although the impulse... Can you hear me?
I need you to speak up just a little bit.
Okay. I'm going to put the mic almost in my mouth here.
Good.
Okay. Although the impulse to move may spring from a source in the unconscious, she's talking about authentic movement now, which I think we'll talk about in a bit. Although the impulse to move may spring from a source in the unconscious, the body, which allows the impulse to manifest itself, remains firmly rooted in the fact of its own existence. The actual act of moving creates proprioceptive and kinesthetic feedback, which serves to confront the unconscious with the body ego's reality. As the unconscious impulse, okay, so here's the unconscious coming up in little movements or unexpected ways of breathing or feelings that surprise us. So as that unconscious impulse and the body ego, what we think of ourselves, how we identify ourselves, as they encounter each other's different realities and intense and fully mutual education is likely to occur. So what she's talking about is this challenging thing of developing the capacity to bear the tension of the opposites,
mm-hmm.
as Jung would say, to fully open to the unconscious while at the same time maintaining a strong conscious orientation in the body.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, and there's a lot of tension in doing that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm also aware that, you know, a lot of us have been disassociated from our bodies, and so we're not necessarily picking up those messages.
That's right. That's right. In fact, disassociation is one of the, what can I say, probably one of the most common ways that in our culture, or maybe in any culture, but certainly in ours, when we're leaving the body, that's one of the ways we do it. I have a friend and colleague that you know as well, Colleen, and many people who are listening may know or be familiar with his work, wonderful Jungian analyst Donald Kalshed, who's written extensively on trauma. And he talks about it as experiences of inhibition, dismissal of the child's expression when they are coming forward with that kind of indelible, spirited spark, that soul spark, and they get shut down because they haven't behaved correctly, or their parents don't have the patience, or their parents weren't allowed to be joyous. And when they see it, it's painful for them, because if they became more conscious of that, they would grieve.
Mm-hmm.
And Don says, you know, he describes these operations of what he calls defensive disassociative processes that are used by the child during traumatic experience in which affect in the body, okay, the emotions in the body, is severed, disconnected from its corresponding images in the mind, and thereby an unbearably painful meaning is obliterated. So what he's talking about there is how when we have more of a sense of fullness, we have a sense of the emotions we're having, or we have greater access to them, to the sensations in the body, and to access to our imagination,
mm-hmm.
to memories. But when something is unbearable, something happens in the moment that's so shocking that you just can't take it in. You have to leave the house of your body and kind of go upstairs into the attic or shoot out into the stars or whatever it is that your spirit is doing to survive.
Mm-hmm.
It leaves the body there kind of numb. So a lot of this work is really about recovering from disassociation, because when we get disassociated, we're not only detached from the environment, in other words, the person or situation that's hurting us, but also from the self, you know, from our body, from our own actions, from our own sense of identity. You know, the body is the basis of our own human subjectivity.
Yeah, I'm just struck as you say that, but it seems like if those two are disconnected, we're not really getting nurtured or fed.
No.
On either a body or a psyche level.
No.
Either one.
No. And I think, you know, well said, Colleen. I think that's where addictions come in, because, or one of the ways, because we're trying to feed ourselves with a false god.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with doing the best we can to try to fill up a kind of emptiness or to overstimulate ourselves to feel something.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be, you know, through a drug to get high or overstimulated, cocaine, you know, or something else, speed. It might be, you know, through alcohol. It might be through food. Marion, you know, made a further development of Jung's work when she talked about how in her work with women who are really struggling with addictions, and I was so moved by how you talked about using different things to create different states of mind and how many of us don't do that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So in one way or another, I mean, it can be work, it can be television, it can be email,
mm-hmm.
any of the things that distract you or keep you out of your lived experience in the moment. But she said, and she was amplifying on Jung, you know, there's specific things we reach for to try to fill the void. And she was saying with alcohol, often it's spirit, you know, spirit in the body, spirit in the bottle.
Mm.
Or if it's cocaine, we might be reaching for light. Or if we're addicted to sex, you know, sex with, not in a loving context with a partner, but, you know, just for the high of it, let's say, where it becomes more mechanical. You know, or used as a source of ecstasy, but you're sort of by yourself in a way,
mm-hmm.
you know, painfully. She says that's a longing for union, to experience real union or intimacy
mm-hmm.
with yourself, with another, with the gods. And she said with food, it's often an attempt to find the mother, you know, to eat the muffin,
mm-hmm.
to feel the sweetness that we missed,
mm-hmm.
And that often our mothers missed. You know, because there have been generations of, you know, the feminine being repressed and
yeah.
not feeling valued.
So it's really important, I think, that we have compassion for ourselves no matter where we find ourselves at, if we're in one of those patterns or if we've taken some strides in healing, is to really have compassion.
Absolutely. I think that's the bottom line. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. I'm aware that our time is flying by really quickly, Tina.
That's amazing. Okay. What else should we talk about?
Well, I'm wondering if you can talk to us more specifically about how authentic movement or any kind of maybe movement gets us back into our bodies and can begin to heal these splits that you're talking about, because ultimately that's where we want to go, to
mm-hmm.
feel loved and in life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well said. Authentic movement is a practice that I love, that I've been doing for many, many years, as have many people increasingly around the globe now. So if I just say a bit about it, it's also called active imagination in movement, or movement in depth. The pioneer was Mary Whitehouse, who was a modern dancer here in California, who studied with Martha Graham, who was interested in myth and dance, and with Mary Wigman, expressive dance in Germany. And she, I mean, we have parallel paths, similarly maybe to my looking at the spark of soul life in the women in the dance class and the men as well. Mary, instead of teaching people after a while to do movements, you know, and to perfect them, a specific modern dance, she got more interested in what in dance therapy we call their unique movement fingerprint. That is, no two people in the world move exactly alike. And helping people become conscious of what was being expressed through their body in the most natural way, without moving from the head, but through, in this practice, closing one's eyes. The mover closes her eyes or his eyes so that they can drop down into their senses and listen more deeply to their own body's experience,
mm-hmm.
and be moved. Be moved from an inner source through their listening. And as the mover is in this process of descent, dropping down into the dark matter of the body, the unknown, the as yet unknown, including any shadow emotions or things like that. By that I mean things that are in the unconscious that have been repressed or just not yet developed, things we don't know about ourselves so well, or we know about and we don't like them, or even good potentials we don't think we have. Those can begin to emerge as the mover is listening and allowing herself to be moved from an inner impulse or from a feeling or from a dream image or from a memory or a mood or even a sound. And as she's doing that, she has a witness who's sitting to the side of the space holding the container, a kind of in a, I think it's a really sacred container, holding the energy, holding the safety in the room so that the mover is free to explore what it is that's as yet unknown or that she hasn't visited in a long time perhaps, and allowing herself to get curious about what might feel scarier for her to explore if there wasn't another compassionate human being there holding sacred space, holding compassion, and being there to talk with her afterwards, to hear her experience, movement, and to reflect back, if she wants, what she, the witness, felt in her own body in response to her mover's movement, any images that may have come. What she's doing is she's inviting the mover to be free, to find different parts of herself in a natural process. And she's there for that, beginning to see the mover more clearly. It's harder for the mover to see herself at first, especially if she hasn't been mirrored very much while she was growing up, if she felt invisible or too big or too little or not good enough or broken somehow or any of these terrible feelings we can have. So there she is, just experiencing what she's literally moving and breathing and experiencing. And if she wants feedback, the witness is reflecting back without judgment or interpretation what she literally saw in the movement, the literal movements, the lifting of the arms, the increasing of the breath, the widening of the chest as the arms go up. I'm doing it now. The additional space for the heart, the coming down to the earth and widening in the pelvis so that the tender organs that you were speaking about, our sitz bones and our sexuality and our digestion and our gut feelings have a place to land and resonate in the body. And so they speak together afterwards, and the witness reflects back the literal movements and how they touched her. And through this process over time, the mover is able to begin to develop a more compassionate, what we call inner witness, or way of seeing herself that's more objective than the difficult stories that she wrapped around to give herself a familiar, if not painful, identity.
Mm-hmm.
So she becomes more real and more embodied in the process to herself and in relationship. So the witnessing, the mirroring that goes on there is similar to the mirroring that happens between the mother and the little baby, you know, where we have the gaze and you're looking in the baby's eyes and they get familiar with you and they have all the feelings that come up in their body.
Mm-hmm.
And they wiggle and giggle or they pause and watch, you know, and there are these little songs, Le Nez, Les Yeux, these little French songs as you touch the nose and the mouth and the ears. And the baby gets to know herself or himself through the mother mirroring, touching, the sound of her voice, the closeness, the mutual resonance that goes on between them, which is what we hope later can become a part of our healing work, both in authentic movement, but also in verbal psychotherapy, where, you know, there aren't just two talking heads in the room, as we know, but two bodies that are resonating together.
Mm.
And it's often the nonverbal material, the dance between the client and the therapist, like the dance between the mother and the baby, that is bringing out more of the emotional material, building a sense of healthier, more secure attachment, and helping the baby, or in this case the client, feel safer in her own skin or his own skin. A lot of times when people start the work, they say, oh, I just want to climb out of my skin. It's like they want to get out of their body because the body is the house of the emotions. That's where they live.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the home of our history. The body is the most authentic history we have is there. Like the rings of a tree,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you can see what the weather conditions were each year that the tree was growing.
Mm-hmm.
How much rainfall there was by how wide the band is. The body, you know, Bessel van der Kolk, who does a lot of trauma work in Boston, says the body remembers. And Mary Whitehouse, she got this from Martha Graham, says the body doesn't lie.
Mm-hmm.
And those phrases are a testament to what can happen when a safe enough space is created for the natural unfolding of more breathing, of natural movement, of images that become safer to have, of feelings that begin to become safer to have. You know, and it's not easy because there's a lot of resistance. The resistances saved our life. So, this isn't something we're going to just jump into.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I've said a lot there. I'm going to pause here.
Yeah, I just want to reflect back and see if I can verbalize this to kind of distill the essence. Would you say that the authentic movement really does two things? It helps us to bring back the lost parts of ourselves.
Yes.
And then brings us to a sense of wholeness because now we're not alienated from our body or psyche, either one, that we are connected.
Mm-hmm.
And what I heard you say, then when we're connected, then we resonate with others in a more connected way. And so that obviously has its rippling effect that goes out and out and out.
Yes. Yes. And furthest out, if we look also at the planet, you know, which you spoke about in your
mm-hmm.
meditation in terms of the root in the planet and that part of us that is connected also with the cosmos. You know, we're on a very tiny, beautiful planet moving through space with lots of other celestial bodies, let's say, and physical bodies. And my sense is, you know, that our personal body is really a microcosm of the Earth's body, let's say. So, in a way, the more we don't take care of our body, or let's say we're moving pretty quickly and we just eat a lot of fast food or junk food, or, you know, you're doing the best you can, but there you are.
Mm-hmm.
We also lose touch with, what can I say, the naturalness of the Earth's body.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes easier if you're disconnected with your body to dump litter on the Earth's body, because it's not a living force.
Mm-hmm.
It's dead matter. It's flat, because that's kind of how you feel,
mm-hmm.
that's flat. And, you know, very painfully, too, if we're not connected to our own body, you know, we can do anything to somebody else's body.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, the multi-generational traumatizing patterns, war, terrorism, you know, all the things that we're struggling with, whether it's, you know, in our families or our communities or around the globe, also have a lot to do with being disembodied. Because when you're connected to your fullness, when you feel more tender, when you feel more compassionate, as you said, you can't do that to another human being.
Mm. Wow, there's so much here and so much richness, and but we have come to the end of our hour, believe
mm-hmm.
it or not.
My goodness, that went fast. Did it go fast for you?
It went really fast.
Okay.
And I want to make sure that we have a chance to open it up to our listeners, but I want to just check in with you to see if there's anything else you'd like to say or add, and also give them your website again, which is www.authenticmovement-bodysoul.com. Did I get that right, Tina?
Yes, yes. And, you know, if people are interested in experiencing the work, there are a number of opportunities there, whether they're weekends or week-longs, you know, whether it's something that I'm offering here or somewhere else in the world, or something that I'm doing with my dear colleagues Meg and Dorothy, whom you know well and interviewed earlier through Wellsprings of Feminine Renewal with the Demeter and Persephone myth this year. We've been doing different fairy tales that have to do with feminine individuation and what Jung calls the sacred marriage. Each year, I also want to say that, you know, if you're calling in and you live in a place that's really far from here and you're not up for traveling, another good resource could be to Google the Authentic Movement Community website, Authentic Movement Community website, because there are many colleagues around the globe who increasingly are beginning to learn and practice and teach this work, some of them for a long, long time and some of them very freshly, in countries all over. And so, you know, if you want access to someone, that's another way, really great way, great resource. And they have a blog where people write in. It's a wonderful website.
Great. So is there anything else you want to add before I open it up to our listening audience?
You asked me when we were talking, you know, a while back, Colleen, about the unholy trinity.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't say a lot about it because of the time, because it'd be great to hear from people. But Jung talked about the unholy trinity, and Joan Chartereau, you know, wrote more about it in her chapter called Move and Be Moved. And basically, Jung said, we've had millennia of the holy trinity. You know, the masculine side or the patriarchal side,
mm-hmm.
With everything that it's brought, you know, the very deeply good things in development and the difficult things as well. And the flip side of that he called the unholy trinity, which is the feminine, the body, and the shadow. And he said, you know, whenever something has been repressed, inevitably it wants to rise up through the earth and come to consciousness. And he talked about how that's what's happening now in this age that we're in, how much the body has suffered you know, it used to be, we used to express our longing for the sacred and our experience of spirit through dance, community dance. But when, for example, the Christian Church and others came in, they forbade a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of that embodied sacred energy went underground, and the body was seen as sinful. And certainly women, you know, had to cover themselves more and behave in a certain way. I mean, men too in some ways. But, you know, what we're seeing in our culture now with women not feeling okay about their bodies or who they are has a lot to do with the historical antecedents of the repression of the unholy trinity coming up now to be known, experienced, grieved, healed, and made more whole now, coming into more of a relationship with what we might call the masculine, logos, thinking, progress, all of those good things that are also more about doing than about being. Mm. So that's the sacred marriage, bringing those two together.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I'm going to stop there. I would love to hear from people.
Wow, and yeah, I just love listening to you, Tina, and I'm sure everybody else did too, so I'm going to press...
Well, I don't know, but we're about to find out.
Yeah, I'm going to press star 5 and make sure, see if anybody else is with us. Hold
okay.
on.
Okay.
Maybe they were never muted. So I hope we have some listeners out there that have some questions for Tina. As you can hear, this is a very rich experience, so much here. So if you have a question, if you can give us your name, and if you're not talking, if you can just mute your call while the person talking is asking the question and getting the response, that would help us get a clear recording. So is there anybody in our listening audience that has any questions?
I have a question. I'm Susanna from Vancouver.
Okay, so we'll start with Susanna, and then I heard somebody else back there, and we'll get
and
you.
Okay. Thank you very much for the wonderful discussion. I was wondering whether you included chronic conditions such as juvenile diabetes and then later complications in life, and how to work with those complications that come at a later stage in life from something that happened at a very young age.
Oh, yeah, thank you for that, Susan.
Tina, you need to raise your voice.
Do I? Okay, now this is what happens when I go into my feeling self. My voice gets rather soft.
And I'm just going to interrupt for a second because I hear a little rustling. If you're not the one speaking right now, if you can mute your phone, *6, and then unmute it when you're ready to speak, that would just help us get some clarity here. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think that'll be
so,
a little better.
Yeah, Suzanne, thank you.
We're pretty much 10 years ago. And we opened because we really...
There's kind of an echo there. Can you hear it?
Okay,
it's quiet now.
*6 to your phone. Okay, can you guys hear now?
There we go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Yeah, these techie things, we're all learning about it. So, Suzanne, I'm going to say just off the top, you know, that I'm not a medical doctor, as you know, so I don't treat specific, you know, physical challenges and ongoing disease processes of that kind in a direct way.
No.
But, yeah, but what I have learned over time is that there's so much that goes on with an illness, whether it's acute or certainly chronic, with different parts of the body beginning to suffer, different ways that we start to compensate for what's not working as well as it might, different ways of beginning to think about ourselves as broken or wounded or disabled or what have you. You know, loss of body function that we know of as ourselves, we start to feel kind of estranged from our sense of self because of lost capacities. So I do find that working in tandem with a physician, whether it's a, you know, an allopathic doctor or an alternative medical doctor, a naturopath, all the different kinds, depending on what the situation is, to allow people to begin to feel safe enough to get curious about their immediate body experience is so helpful, I think, for them to be able to tell their story and feel that they're not being rushed for time, which unfortunately we often experience in the doctor's office. The insurance company is giving them about 7 minutes now, from what I hear from some of my medical colleagues. You know, you barely get yourself in the chair. You're not going to talk about what's really hard right away. And maybe you're not making eye contact either because the person is doing what they can to take notes. And in any case, to have a safe enough place to come gradually back home to your embodied experience and the challenges of movement, the pain or the grief that may be there that starts to get to come forward and unwind a bit. And grief, as hard as it is a really important part of the healing process. It's often holding that back, holding the breath, holding back the tears that keeps things locked up and keeps the healing process from moving forward. So, so being able to recontact oneself as who you are now can be very liberating. It can provide a gradual way to come back home to yourself.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for that question, too.
Yeah.
And we had someone else that spoke.
That was me,
okay,
I think.
Who is this?
This is Ruth in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Oh, hi, Ruth.
Hi, Ruth.
Thank you for being here.
Hi. I had two things, but I'll try to be quick. One of them is I appreciated your description of your experience as a child with ballet, because it helped me understand or be more compassionate about myself as an adult taking Tai Chi lessons, because it was a good experience, except for it was too frustrating to always have, like, need to have my arm, you know, an inch different, or my foot an angle different a little bit or something. I didn't want that kind of perfection to be necessary and things like that. But my other question was, I was just thinking about the disassociation with the body that can happen with very young children, and wondering if you thought, as was coming into my mind, after a kid is toilet trained and then even a while later still has a lot of or some problem with bedwetting and stuff, do you think that bedwetting may be a symptom of dissociation from the body?
Oh, gosh, what a good and big question. I think it's different for every child in many ways and for every family what might be going on there.
Okay.
But I do have the sense, I used to work a lot more with children, and now I work a lot with inner children, with adults. But that material certainly comes forward, and sometimes with children, their children. What I will say is that it seems when there's something upsetting, you know, in the psyche, in the emotions of the child, some tension in the household, or even or on the schoolyard, you know, even if the parents are doing the best they can, maybe there's bullying going on, you know, or maybe the child is frightened of something and they don't feel safe enough to talk about it, or they don't even know what it is that's frightening them. It's not conscious yet. It's in the somatic unconscious. It's being expressed through the body directly. So I think working with children in movement, it couldn't be more natural for them to move. You know, and this might sound a little funny, but if the child feels safe enough, they might even be able to draw what it's like to wet the bed, you know, without having to feel shamed, or maybe they can move, you know, to get in touch with that sensation in a safe way. And maybe then, you know, sound, breath comes out, or sound comes out, or maybe gradually words come out. I hate this, you know, or I'm scared, or, but that's, you know, those are several steps down the road to be able to come on to language from what's in the unconscious in the body.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Your presentation was wonderful.
Thank you. I just want to say one thing about Tai Chi. Thank you for bringing that in, because, you know, there's so many forms of movement practice.
Yes.
And for some, it's really good to start with a more formal kind of movement class where you learn structured movement, hopefully not having to be perfect, but Tai Chi or yoga or martial arts, different beautiful dance forms. And in learning different moves, you begin to experience your body in a different way.
True. True.
You know? And you can begin to get in touch with different feelings than the way we habitually move, our typical movement patterns, each of us.
Right.
You know? So that can be a lovely jumping off point, and then going into self-directed motion or movement, where you're not patterning your body after someone else's movement,
right?
But listening to your own good self, your own body wisdom.
Okay.
That makes sense?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you.
So, Tina, I just want to check in.
I have a question. It's Julia from Toronto.
Hi, Julia.
Hi. I would love to hear more about the process that you use or have created in the dream dancing. I'm very interested in that. I'm wondering if you could speak to that a bit.
Sure. Yeah. Well, dream dancing is a, for example, right now, it's a group I've been doing for the last 12 years, once a month in San Francisco. And so it's a women's group, and people in it have been doing their own therapy, and they have some background in movement or yoga or breath work or some way to be alert to or awakened to their experience of their body. And I invite them to bring a significant dream each time, or sometimes it's their favorite fairy tale, or sometimes it's a body symptom. I don't like to call them symptoms. I like to call them body messages, you know. But basically, in lots of different ways, we welcome the dream image and how it's animating the body. So it's not just like telling a dream, like being entertained by a movie.
Welcome to the world of greater mentality.
Wow.
Metastics are a part
of something else is coming in.
Yeah,
I
love that.
If you're not the one asking the question, can you mute your phones, please? Press star 6 because we've got a little interference on the line.
Of the approach.
Okay. Well, welcome to the world. That was a great statement. I'm Jungian enough to be interested in synchronicities like that.
The dream world.
So then what we do is we drop the dream into the body. What I mean by that is, as you share the dream with another, either with the group and with me or with another participant more intimately in twos or threes, you begin to become aware of where and how the dream is living in your body at that moment. What is the juiciest part of the dream, or the most challenging or intriguing or energized part of the dream that you want to know more about? Or maybe you don't want to know about it, but you know it's important. And how is that living or animating your body? You know, is it swirling in your belly? Is it rocking your pelvis? Is it softening your heart? Is it making you want to run or move your arms around? Is it making you want to cry out or sing? What is that energy that's trying to be expressed? Because as one of my teachers used to say, Stanley Kellerman, he does formative psychology through the Center for Energetic Studies in Berkeley. He says, dreams are rehearsals for action. Dreams are the body speaking its mind. So it's as if from an embodied or somatic standpoint, we can say from a spiritual or Jungian standpoint that dreams are gifts that get given to us or dropped into our psyche maybe, but are also trying to express our spiritual dilemmas and condition or our emotional situation. And from a somatic or embodied standpoint, we could say that they're outpicturing of, what can I say, movements that are trying to be made in the body that are emotional, or the mix, what's going on in the organ systems trying to speak their mind. So, for example, if we move, if we're just moving, and then that night we have a dream, the dream becomes a kind of outpicturing of the reality that we experienced in our bodies during the day. It's a kind of a picture of what happened for us that helps us bring more clarity to what it might mean, what we experienced in our body. And similarly, the body grounds the image, the dreams, in emotional reality. So it's not just an entertaining story. So in dream dancing, we're working back and forth, listening to these gestures that want to emerge, that speak directly from the nonverbal, emotional midbrain, you could say, where the images are formed in the brain. So we're not going to just interpret them with the left brain logos thinking self through associations. That can be very, very important. It helps connect it to memory and so on. But we're also connecting it very directly to our emotional reality and our dilemmas and the movements that may have been thwarted and not completed or fully lived that may want to come forward, that are being indicated by a particular character in the dream who's able to do something that we don't think we can do, for example. That would be a kind of shadow figure. Well, she can do that. I'm not able to do that, but she can. Or she's doing stuff that I shouldn't do, but there she is in my dream. I wonder what got stirred up yesterday. You know, maybe I need to be a little spicier. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It actually reminds me of Arnold Mendel's work, and I was wondering whether there is quite a bit of overlap or difference, not to compare work at all. I'm sure it's your work is very individual, and I've read a few of his books, and I'm just becoming aware of your work. I'm just wondering if there is some similarity there is between the two.
I would say yes.
Or differences. But.
Yeah, I would say yes and yes. So Arnold Mendel was one of my teachers in Zurich.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in Zurich, long in the 80s, and then in Portland and at Esalen, because I was working with dreams in the body, and I found out about him. I was going over there to interview von Franz, and she told me about him because he'd been a physicist. He was brilliant, but he got so ill that he realized he needed to learn as much as he could about the body, and that set him on his path with process-oriented psychology. So Working with the Dreaming Body, his really early book, is a great source you may have read. He talks a lot about the channels, which are the different sensory systems. And so I'm working with doing what I can to support people in opening the senses again for the living body to, you know, become more vital. And one of those is also the proprioceptive, the inner body felt sensations, and the kinesthetic, the movement channel. So I tend to focus on those a bit more, but also on the visual mm-hmm. centers in the emotional midbrain where the dreaming comes from. But I mm-hmm. found my work through dance therapy, you know, and through Reichian work and through Jungian work. And he found his way, you know, through his own illness. As I said earlier, it's often through the wounding that we find our life path.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the sharing. That's wonderful.
Great question.
You're welcome. Thank you for the question.
So, I believe we have, it's 2:24. We have time for about one more question probably.
Wow, okay.
So does somebody else have a question you'd like to ask Tina? Press star 6 to unmute yourself. Are there any other questions?
Or responses.
Yeah, or reflections.
Tina, this is Susan from Pacifica.
Oh, Susan, hello.
Hi, honey.
Hi.
I just wanted to leave a comment. I have just loved this time on the phone and so appreciate your contribution and your work. And I just want to encourage anybody that's listening. I've had Tina as a teacher. I've done some dance and dream work with her. And I'm heading to Italy with her this summer. And it is life-changing to dance and move with the images, to write about them, to paint them, to draw them. And I just can give a hearty, hearty recommendation that the work is transformative and powerful and very healing for the body. I come from an extensive background of sexual abuse and physical abuse, and the work has been very paramount in my own healing. So I just wanted to say thank you and give a strong recommendation for anybody that's interested to do the work in the Bay Area or in Italy or up at the Buddhist Retreat Center. But if you get a chance to work with Tina in person, you will be it will change your life. So I just wanted to say that.
Well, Susan, thank you very much. I mean, thank you. I'm very moved by that, and it's great to hear from you. And I've learned from you, too,
mm-hmm.
you know, in this work. We learn from each other. So mm-hmm. thank you. I'm very touched by that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
Yeah.
So one more quick question, possibly. Anybody else want to speak up before we close? Do we have any more questions?
Well, people are either offline or they're dropped into their own experience. for work that's so nonverbal, there's been a lot of talking.
Yeah, but it's been wonderful.
Oh, good. You know, I was thinking of a quote from Martha Graham. Maybe I could give that to all of us at the ending.
That would be awesome.
Is that all right?
That
would
be great.
She was one of, one of Mary Whitehouse's main teachers, and this is a fabulous quote that many of you may know, but it's so encouraging. She says, "There is a vitality, a life force, an energy, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And because there is only one you in all time, this expression is unique. And if you block it, it will never exist through any other medium. The world will not have it. It is not your business to determine how good it is, nor how valuable, nor how it compares with other expressions. It is your business to keep it yours clearly and directly, to keep the channel open."
So may we all find a way and find the courage to keep our channels open, to reconnect to the wisdom of our body souls. And I really thank you, Tina, for sharing your time and your knowledge and expertise again with us today. And thank you, all of our audience, for staying tuned and listening. We appreciate all of you so much.
Thank you, Colleen.
Next week. Thank you.
Thank you for this invitation, and thank you all for being part of this. This is how it happens when we
thank
gather
you,
together.
Tina.
You're welcome.
Sarah, yeah, it's great having you on the line. So, Tina, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay.
It feels like someone's playing the piano.
Yeah. I will call you on my cell phone and just kind of
okay.
If you have a minute.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Good. I'd be happy to. Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.